to New York as we continue the memoirs of the American singer-songwriter, artist and poet Patti Smith. Just kids. Born in New Jersey in 1946, Patti headed to New York in 1967 to seek her fortune, and there a chance encounter changes her life forever.
My favorite object was a modest necklace from Persia. It was made of two enameled metal plaques bound together with heavy black and silver threads, like a very old and exotic scapular. It cost $18, which seemed like a lot of money. When things were quiet, I would take it out of its case and trace the calligraphy etched upon its violet surface and dream up tales of its origins. Shortly after I started working there, the boy I had met briefly in Brooklyn came into the store. He looked quite different in his white shirt and tie, like a Catholic schoolboy. He explained that he worked at Brentano's downtown branch and had a credit slip he wanted to use. He spent a long time looking at everything, the beads, the small figurines, the turquoise rings. Finally, he said, "I want this." It was the Persian necklace. "Oh, it's my favorite too," I answered. "It reminds me of a scapular." "Are you a Catholic?" he asked me. "No, I just like Catholic things." I was an altar boy, he grinned at me. I loved to swing the frankincense censer. I was happy because he had selected the piece I singled out, yet sad to see it go. When I wrapped it and handed it to him, I said impulsively, "Don't give it to any girl but me." I was immediately embarrassed, but he just smiled and said, "I won't." Demoralized by hunger, I was shocked when there was no envelope for me on payday. I had not understood that the first week's pay was withheld, and I went back to the cloakroom in tears. When I returned to my counter, I noticed a guy lurking around, watching me. He had a beard and was wearing a pinstripe shirt and one of those jackets with suede patches on the elbows. The supervisor introduced us. He was a science fiction writer, and he wanted to take me out to dinner. Even though I was 20, my mother's warning not to go anywhere with a stranger reverberated in my consciousness. But the prospect of dinner weakened me, and I accepted. I hoped the guy, being a writer, would be okay, though he seemed more like an actor playing a writer. We walked down to a restaurant at the base of the Empire State Building. I had never eaten at a nice place in New York City. I tried to order something that wasn't too expensive and chose swordfish, $5.95, the cheapest thing on the menu. I can still see the waiter setting the plate before me with a big wad of mashed potatoes and a slab of overdone swordfish. Even though I was starving, I could hardly enjoy it. I felt uncomfortable and had no idea how to handle the situation or why he wanted to eat with me. It seemed like he was spending a lot of money on me, and I got to worrying what he would expect in return. After the meal, we walked all the way downtown. We went east to Tompkins Square Park and sat on a bench. I was conjuring lines of escape when he suggested we go up to his apartment for a drink. This was it, I thought, the pivotal moment my mother had warned me about. I was looking around desperately, unable to answer him, when I saw a young man approaching. It was as if a small portal of future opened, and out stepped the boy from Brooklyn who had chosen the Persian necklace, like an answer to a teenage prayer. I immediately recognized his slightly bow-legged gait and his tousled curls. He was dressed in dungarees and a sheepskin vest. Around his neck hung strands of beaded necklaces, a hippie shepherd boy. I ran up to him and grabbed his arm. "Hello, do you remember me?" "Of course," he smiled. "I need help," I blurted. "Will you pretend you're my boyfriend?" "Sure," he said, as if he wasn't surprised by my sudden appearance. I dragged him over to the science fiction guy. "This is my boyfriend," I said breathlessly. "He's been looking for me. He's really mad. He wants me to come home now." The guy looked at us both quizzically. "Run," I cried, and the boy grabbed my hand and we took off through the park across to the other side. Out of breath, We collapsed on someone's stoop. "Thank you. You saved my life," I said. He accepted this news with a bemused expression. "I never told you my name. It's Patty."
"My name is Bob."
"Bob," I said, really looking at him for the first time. "Somehow, you don't seem like a Bob to me. Is it okay if I call you Robert?"
The sun had set over Avenue B. He took my hand, and we wandered the East Village. He bought me an egg cream at Jem's Spa on the corner of St. Mark's Place and 2nd Avenue. I did most of the talking. He just smiled and listened. I was surprised at how comfortable and open I felt with him. He told me later that he was tripping on acid. We walked around until 2 in the morning, and finally, almost simultaneously, revealed that neither one of us had a place to go. We laughed about that, but it was late and we were both tired. "I think I know somewhere we can stay," he said. His last roommate was out of town. "I know where he hides his key. I don't think he would mind." We got the subway out to Brooklyn. His friend lived in a little place on Waverly near the Pratt campus. We went through an alleyway where he found the key hidden beneath a loose brick and led ourselves into the apartment. We both fell shy when we entered, not so much because we were alone together as that it was someone else's place. Robert busied himself making me comfortable and then, in spite of the late hour, asked if I would like to see his work that was stored in a back room. Robert spread it out over the floor for me to see. There were drawings, etchings, and he unrolled some paintings that reminded me of Richard Poisedart and Henri Michaux. Multifarious energies radiated through interweaving words and calligraphic line. Energy fields built with layers of word, paintings and drawings that seemed to emerge from the subconscious. I was particularly moved by the drawing he had done on Memorial Day. I had never seen anything like it. What also struck me was the date, Joan of Arc's feast day, the same day I'd promised to make something of myself before her statue. I told him this, and he responded that the drawing was symbolic of his own commitment to art, made on the same day. He gave it to me without hesitation, and I understood that in this small space of time, we had mutually surrendered our loneliness and replaced it with trust. We looked at books on Dada and Surrealism and ended the night immersed in the slaves of Michelangelo. Wordlessly, we absorbed the thoughts of one another and, just as dawn broke, fell asleep in each other's arms. When we awoke, he greeted me with his crooked smile, and I knew he was my knight. As if it was the most natural thing in the world, we stayed together, not leaving each other's side save to go to work. Nothing was spoken. It was just mutually understood. When we had finally saved enough money, Robert looked for a place for us to live. We paid $160 to move into 160 Hall Street. We regarded the symmetry as favorable. When I came to New York, I had bought a few colored pencils and a wood slate to draw on. I had drawn a girl at a table before a spread of cards, a girl divining her fate. It was the only drawing I had to show Robert, which he liked very much. He wanted me to experience working with fine paper and pencils and shared his materials with me. We would work side by side for hours in a state of mutual concentration. We hadn't much money, but we were happy. Robert worked part-time and took care of the apartment. I did the laundry and made our meals, which were very limited. We had our work and one another. We didn't have the money to go to concerts or movies or buy new records, but we played the ones we had over and over. We listened to My Madame Butterfly as sung by Eleanor Stieber, A Love Supreme, Between the Buttons, Joan Baez, and Blonde on Blonde. Robert introduced me to his favorites, Vanilla Fudge, Tim Buckley, Tim Hardin, and his History of Motown provided the backdrop for our nights of communal joy. One Indian summer day, we dressed in our favorite things, me in my beatnik sandals and ragged scarves, and Robert with his love beads and sheepskin vest. We took the subway to West 4th Street
and spent the afternoon in Washington Square. We shared coffee from a thermos, watching the stream of tourists, stoners, and folk singers. Agitated revolutionaries distributed anti-war leaflets. Chess players drew a crowd of their own. Everyone coexisted within the continuous drone of verbal diatribes, bongos, and barking dogs. We walked toward the fountain, the epicenter of activity, when an older couple stopped and openly observed us. Robert enjoyed being noticed, and he affectionately squeezed my hand. "Oh, take their picture," said the woman to her bemused husband. "I think they're artists." "Nah, go on," he shrugged. "They're just kids." We took walks at night. Sometimes we could see Venus above us. It was the shepherd star and the star of love. Robert called it our blue star. He practiced forming the T of Robert into a star, signing in blue so that I would remember. I was getting to know him. He had absolute confidence in his work and in me. Yet he worried incessantly about our future, how we would survive, about money. I felt we were too young to have such cares. I was happy just being free. The uncertainty of the practical side of our life haunted him, though I did my best to stay his worries. On November 4th, Robert turned 21. I gave him a heavy silver ID bracelet I found in a pawn shop on 42nd Street. I had it engraved with the words, "Robert, Patty, Blue Star, the blue star of our destiny." Robert got laid off from Brentano's. He spent his unemployed days in the continual transformation of our living space. When he painted the kitchen, I was so happy that I prepared us a special meal. I made couscous with anchovies and raisins, and my specialty, lettuce soup. This delicacy consisted of chicken bouillon garnished with lettuce leaves. But soon after Robert was laid off, I also got fired. I was not sorry to leave. The best thing about the place had been the Persian necklace and meeting Robert, who, true to his word, had not given the necklace to another girl. On our first night together at Hall Street, he gave me the cherished necklace wrapped in violet tissue and tied with black satin ribbon. In the beginning of March, Robert got a temporary job as an usher for the newly opened Fillmore East. He reported for duty in an orange jumpsuit. He was looking forward to seeing Tim Buckley. But when he came home, he was more excited by someone else. "I saw someone who's going to be really big," he said. It was Janis Joplin. We didn't have the money to go to concerts, but before Robert left the Fillmore, he got me a pass to see the Doors. I had devoured their first album, but I had a strange reaction watching Jim Morrison. Everyone around me seemed transfixed, but I observed his every move in a state of cold hyper-awareness. I remember this feeling much more clearly than the concert. I felt, watching Jim Morrison, that I could do that.
Oh, tell me where your freedom lies. The streets are fields that never die.
And tomorrow, Patty and Robert join writers, artists, and musicians at the Chelsea Hotel. Just Kids was written and read by Patty Smith. It was abridged by Jeremy Osborne and produced by Rosalind Ward.
I do like that after 15 years of doing this programme, we can still find a new way to explore, and we've never before on Ramblings been rowing.
Claire Balding embarks on a new series of inspirational walks.
We emerge at the coastline, at the sea, the waves crashing into the bay down on the left, the sun falling in a giant spotlight beam and creating a mile-wide mirror of water.
Ramblings, starting on Thursday afternoon at 3 over on BBC Radio 4.
BBC BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock and it's Joanna Pinnock here with an hour of afternoon drama. It's Thomas Hardy's last novel, Jude the Obscure, and Jude is still in hot pursuit of his dreams of self-improvement and his cousin Sue. Mel gives the birthday bumps to singer Ed Sheeran in today's 4 o'clock show. There's more Junior Just a Minute, and it's part two of Roald Dahl's The Witches, read by Kathy Burke. All that to look forward to in an hour. So now, despite his rejection by the academics of Christminster, Jude Fawley remains optimistic about the chances of bettering himself. Today he heads for Melchester, where his cousin Sue has gone to become a teacher. That's in part three of Jude the Obscure.
Melchester. Sky overcast, mist gathering. A quiet place of ecclesiastical modesty. A soothing place. Please God, I shall do some good thing here. It's been shown that I lack brilliance, but I have determination. God preserve that in me. And a calling. God preserve that in me. Most famous Gothic spire in England. It rises more and more remotely, dwindling, the apex lost in the mist, invisible. Hidden, as so often is the face of God hidden from those who seek him. The close. Round it, houses, homes of the clergy. And at its edge, another reason for my presence here. An institution in an ancient edifice of the 15th century. Once a palace, I believe, mullioned and transomed windows. Something of a fortress.
Dear Jude, I am rather lonely and quite miserable. I hate this place. I wish you'd come immediately.
Please God, they'll let me see her. She wishes me to be here. Someone wishes for my presence. I shall greet her. How? As cousin? Yes, it must be as cousin.
I don't think I have ever been anywhere so desolate or alien to me.
She knows the worst of me, yet asked me here, sent for me. Outside in the close, the lamps are being lit.